I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. And before we leap into meeting our OSI fellows, I want to remind you that support for WEAA is provided by Chef Max Louisiana Cuisine, available for catering for all holiday parties and special occasions. Open Monday through Thursday, 12 p.m. to 8 p.m., and Fridays and Saturdays, 12 p.m. to 9 p.m., located at 4311 Hartford Road. For more information, 410-319-6227. That's 410-319-6227. It makes me hungry just reading that. But we are here in the studio now with three fellows from the Open Society Institute. Jessica Terrell is with us. She's founder of Hand in Hand, an organization working to lower the juvenile recidivism rate. Coley Tengela.
Yes, indeed. Hey, Mark.
Hey, Coley, who I've known for too many years to even think about, is a who is a comedian and teacher working with students to develop theater and filmmaking troupe built around Sesame Street and hip-hop and more. We'll hear about that. And Michelle Foreman Shields.
I got to give my whole legal
name,
because
it says right there, girl.
That's
your name on the
fellowship.
Paper.
You know I'm Michelle, the indie mom of comedy.
Oh, my God.
Also known as Michelle Foreman Shields.
So I don't need to introduce her anymore, do I? It's all over now. I won't call you. I won't call your last name at all.
That's the rest my
of the show.
Social Security name.
I talked to your husband today too.
I hope so.
I did.
Good.
She's a founder of Gold Diggers, the Sankofa Project, which will encourage African American girls to study their ancestry and heritage, Native American and African American heritage. And Michelle, good to have you here.
Good to be here, Mark, as always.
And the number is 410-319-8888. This is, are you also the Bamberger Fellow?
Yes, I am. Named good evening, everyone. So nice to be here. Thank you.
Good to have you here.
Oh, yeah, she's the Bamberger Fellow. All of us, the rest of us, are just mere OSI Baltimore Community Fellows. She's the Clinton Bamberger Fellow.
No, I love Jessica. Let me tell you right now.
And she's the youngest among y'all, too.
Yeah, Jessica, I got about a couple dozen years on her.
No, everyone is great, but it's truly an honor to be named the Bamberg Fellow because he's an amazing man.
Clinton,
and I hope he's listening tonight.
Clinton probably is. He listens to the show a lot. Clinton Bamberger, I'll just say for a moment, is just retired from the Open Society Institute board, and we'll explain a little bit about that, what these fellows mean in that sense. But Clinton Bamberger is one of the great pioneers of this world, not just this country. I mean, Clinton is he's one of my heroes. That in 20 years, when I'm his age, I want to be Clinton Bamberger.
Gotcha.
He has helped start the judicial system in South Africa, post-apartheid, and fighting apartheid during apartheid, working with the justice system there, did work in Nepal. Under President John F. Kennedy, he helped start the Legal Services Corporation, ran the Legal Services Corporation. He was dean of law school at Georgetown. He's just an amazing activist and thinker. Ran for attorney general here on a very progressive ticket before that was popular in the early 60s. A fighter for human rights. I love Clinton and Catherine both as his wife, and they're very dear friends of ours. We have dinner a lot, and I had to say that being you have the honor to have his fellowship.
Yes,
fellow
named
him is a real honor. He's a great brother, good man. So, Baltimore boy too, grew up here. That's right. So, the Open Society Institute. He's been doing a lot of work in this town, and they work around a lot of criminal justice and juvenile justice issues, and really put forward a very progressive agenda about how to change our juvenile justice system. And in many ways, all the things the three of you are working on touches the heart and soul of that work, I think, about reaching out to young people in this community and addressing issues that very few people even we're not bothering to address at the moment.
Yeah.
All of you are doing that.
I would just like to say...
As a senior member of the group, right?
Yes, I am.
Mark, you are out of control. You are out of control, Mark Steiner.
I'm his senior. I was his teacher 25 years ago, 30 years ago.
You got to date beautiful. This man. Give this.
So, yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Mark knows.
I just dated myself.
Yeah. First of all, I just really would like to thank the board and the staff of Open Society Institute Baltimore for having the tremendous insight of selecting the seven of us to be this year's fellows. They are absolutely brilliant and insightful to see the progressive work that we're doing. I'm joking, but I'm serious too, because one thing this fellowship has done, in particularly for myself, it affirms me, and I'm quite sure my fellows would agree, that it affirms you, because after a while you begin to think that you're alone and isolated, mm-hmm. that people don't believe that the mm-hmm. progressive, positive social justice work that you're doing is appreciated. That, it's okay if you want to empower young African-American girls from a disfranchised community, or you want to work as, you know, one of my fellows is working on empowering young men who are incarcerated, who are justly or unjustly sentenced as adults, or using the art to teach life skills and academic skills to empower not only children but adults too, and thereby uplift your community, that you begin to think after a while that it's fruitless and unappreciated by the dominant society and culture. But you do get the love and the acknowledgement of the adults you work with and the children that you work with and the communities that you work with. This has been very affirming to me that progressive, empowering, social justice, ideas and concepts and people are appreciated, and we should not lose hope in this current climate that the dignity and sanctity of human beings, people over things, is still appreciated.
So I agree. I think that's why this thing is important. I'd like you all could just let me go down the line here. I'd like you to describe the projects that you're working in. Just listen to the sense of the kinds of things Open Society Institute is backing. Some of the people who won got a fellowship this time is a man who's working in how to take the urban farms that are developing all across Baltimore City now, how to market those goods and actually get them to the people who need to eat them.
Yeah, it's Gary.
We can't wait to talk to him as well later. There's so many interesting projects coming out of these fellows. But Michelle, talk about you've talked a little bit about this project before.
Yeah.
But share it with the listeners.
But you know what, Mark? I want to acquiesce because with Jessica being the first Clinton Bamberger fellow, I would love to draw that. No, it just seemed apropos to draw that line because, of course, of all his work, you know, in law, and then her work that she's doing with young brothers who are charged as adults. Jessica, I think, would be great to start it off. What do you think, Jessica?
All right.
Okay.
I think I'd be great. Thank you.
That's a good idea.
Yes, indeed.
But
I'd
like to say I think that everyone's work is amazing, and it's really, truly an honor to be able to know some of these people because they've been helping me. They've been inspiring me. But I want to thank OSI for really empowering the people that we work with. So like Mr. Coley said, it's great when we can get affirmed, but it's also great when our young people or our adults that we're working with are affirmed as well, because people hear about our projects, they come and support the young men, or they come to a play, or they come and teach a life skill session. And so I think it's wonderful because not only do we need that affirmation, but so do our young people or our adults. But I work mostly with young people. So Hand to Hand is the name of my nonprofit. I started in September 2009 because I just really got tired of seeing young men charged as adults coming in and out of the Baltimore City Detention Center. The young men, about 70% of them, were getting released without services, and then they were returning, and it wasn't really a shock. It's like, okay, you send me home, but you don't provide me with any services. What do you think I'm going to do? And so I started with two graduate students who came in. They were helping me with the counseling. I was leading group therapy, and now we do academic mentoring, mental health, and case management services for all of our young people who are charged as adults and reside in Baltimore's City Detention Center, but also upon their release. And what I think is great is that this model is replicable. So it could be a hand-to-hand Baltimore, a hand-to-hand Detroit, a hand-to-hand New York, because what it at the foundation is really working with young people or working with students. Most of my volunteers are graduate students or college students who are coming in who are tired of seeing young people being thrown away or children being killed, as we like to say, because you send them in as children, but they don't come out that way.
Right.
And so super excited to be here.
Because we've had a show about juveniles who are incarcerated in adult institutions, and mothers were on the program. One mother was on the program that day, and her story was just heart-wrenching about the young boy who was adjudicated, I don't know if innocent, but he was not charged after being in jail for almost a year, mm-hmm. at 16 years old in an adult prison. And she said the boy that came home was not the same child that left. Mm-hmm. In terms of communication and closeness, he was just transformed in that prison in a very negative way. Mm-hmm. And that's a very real issue that, you know, what we're doing to young people, especially young people of color in this society, and locking them up by the hundreds of thousands, mm-hmm. when there may be an alternative way to deal with it. So I think that it was right, and given the program and the stuff that Clinton has been working on, that we should be named that fellow. And I think I congratulate you for that.
Thank you.
Michelle, talk about, about this program.
And I'm so proud to be in the class that first honors the Bamberger
Amen.
Fellow. But just so that everyone's clear, and they share with us, it's not that Jessica's getting anything differently from us in terms of support.
Right.
She's just being honored for having such insight at this season of her life. Jessica's still in her early 20s. And to have that kind of insight is absolutely refreshing because, again, people think that when you're in your 20s, you're in such a place of it's all about me. Mm-hmm. This is the complete opposite. Jessica is showing that she's definitely interested in the lives of others. But my project is quite different from anything I think that's been done at OSI. I think this apropos, because I'm quite different from anybody that's probably ever been in OSI.
You are different, but, that's for sure.
Cool beans, Mark Steiner. Yeah. So my project is entitled Goal Diggers. So that if you guys
G-O-A-L.
Are listening. G-O-A-L. Goal Diggers, / the Sankofa Project. And basically Goal Diggers will take 15 girls from the Park Heights community, which is a community where I was raised, where I was born. My grandmother still lives there, 80 years old. My auntie still lives there. I have tons of family in Park Heights. And I created this program because the Park Heights that I grew up in is staunchly different from the Park Heights that exist now. When I was there in the 70s, it was working class families, Bethlehem Steel lifers, Sinai Hospital lifers, you know, teachers and all kinds of folks, two parent homes. And then with that whole onset of the epidemic of drugs and post Vietnam, it turned into something else, and it still has that trickle down effect that has affected families. So it has the largest numbers of some of the most disparaging statistics in the city. And so I'm working with 15 African-American girls, and I'm going to be introducing them to the science of DNA, and I'm going to be working that through anthropology, teaching them about their ancestry, their heritage. So we're going to be journaling. I'm going to help them learn how to do ethnographic research, which is just a fancy word for storytelling, gathering stories from your families. We're going to take those stories, and we're going to use technology to help fill in the gaps. We're going to do that post-slavery fill-in of the family tree. We'll get your information from your auntie and your mother and your aunt and your father. We'll put it into Ancestry.com. We'll find out where these folks came from in terms of their American experience, and then we're going to journal about it. We're going to take them to cultural excursions up and down the Northeast region, have them sitting with Dr. Skip Gates to hear about how his research with Oprah Winfrey and Chris Tucker and Emmett Smith changed the foundation of their lives. And then we're going to journal this process, and we're also going to have access to some of the most amazing speakers. One of my favorite people is my partner, Dr. Raymond Winbush, who's here at Morgan State University.
Brilliant man.
Who I had the brilliance and opportunity, not the brilliance, but the humble opportunity to sit under him for a year as one of his apprentices for the Warrior Institute, named after his awesome book, The Warrior Method. Took me to Ghana, taught me about the Pearl Society. So he's going to give me access, front door access, to all of his colleagues, folks who were with him when he was on Oprah, deconstructing the whole Crash movie and all that kind of great stuff. And so Dr. Winbush is going to help us gather our lecturers for the lecture series that the girls are going to be privy to. These lecturers are going to be talking about the importance of understanding your ancestry, your heritage, but they're also going to be sharing insight about DNA. You know, with this whole CSI phenomenon going on, younger people are really getting excited about science in a different way. So I'm going to have each girl tested on their maternal side in their DNA. And we're going to have them tested. It's 99% accurate that every girl has her mother's blood. And with the African Heritage program that we're using, they're going to be able to trace back succinctly, if they are of African descent, which I feel strongly they will be, what country in the contemporary sense they come from on the continent, and in some cases, what tribe. And then we're going to study those countries intricately, their mores, their values, their, you know, the things they were noted for. We're going to basically pull the pieces back together that we missed from being here only in the American experience. So you're no longer just a girl from Park Heights. You're not just a girl from Baltimore. You're not just a girl. You're not just baby niece. You know what I mean? It's not even a sentence, baby niece. But most of the time, that's right. baby niece from Park Heights. You're not that person anymore. You're now a gold digger who has found out whose you really are. You've connected the dots. So you're going to travel to Ghana with me at the end of the year, and we're going to visit the Elmina slave castles, and we're going to visit University of Accra, and we're going to go to the Abore village, and we're going to do all these amazing things, go to the home and mausoleum of W.E.B. Du Bois. You know, places that I was blessed to go to as an adult. I want to take you there as a 14 to 18-year-old. I hope that this experience will change your value system, will bolster your self-esteem, will give you what my friends had, who my Jewish friends who knew they were Hungarian Jew or Polish Jew or Russian Jew and would go to Israel in the summer and go to Hebrew school, and my Italian friends who knew they were Sicilian and their mother made the best. You know, you'll know this stuff. Or my Irish friends who was like, you know, kissing the Blarney Stone. I mean, you're going to know this stuff. It's going to connect the dots for you. And as you can tell, I'm extremely excited about it. And once we return, you're no longer gold diggers. You're miners. And your responsibility is to share your gold digging experience with the next class. And again, I feel like it's replicable because we can have gold diggers all over the country.
Yes.
And hopefully you'll be more responsible for yourself, more civically engaged. You won't be able to come out of your house and see trash on your front and just walk past it, after you've been to Ghana and you've sat with people who have a third or a fifth or a tenth of what you think is important, and yet they have so much self-love and so much pride in their home that they sweep their floors down or they sweep the dust, you know. So I'm hoping that it gives them a shift and they'll engage the educational process differently and take advantage of a free education, where when you go to Ghana, you'll see these kids, if they don't pay for school, they don't go to school. Primary, secondary, and on and on and on. So I'm really excited about it, Mark, and I'm looking to get support from my friends who are in the industry. I have lots of friends who want to help, who've already put themselves out there. One of my good friends, Grammy Award-winning Regina Bell, wants to do a private concert, to do stuff. I mean, I have friends who really, really want to pour into this project to see their lives shifted. So I'm very excited.
Well, that's great. I love this. Coley.
You know, Coley Tengela. You know, I am humbled and in awe. Mark, I mentioned earlier that I was so impressed with Open Society Baltimore choosing us as community fellows. The brilliance of these two dynamic, brilliant African women right here in America doing such empowering, incredible work, you know, it is humbling. And for all of us fellows to be given this opportunity by OSI is tremendous. And those are just two examples. And me being able to share my skills and what I've learned over the several years of not only being a stand-up comic, actor, and a writer, and the last couple of years actually becoming what I've really had an interest in, becoming a filmmaker, and using that to empower young people and adults. And let me just share exactly what my program will entail. I will be developing a youth and adult traveling theater troupe with a filmmaking component that will be doing performances that will reinforce literacy and also life skill development. Thereby, the plays will be done from street corners to concert halls, and then we will actually be doing scripted feature films and using the technology of the digital technology, be able to give multiple choice endings to the academic portions where you can select your endings and see if you have the correct answer, but also in terms of life skill development, young people who are struggling with their own sense of self-esteem, who might be lured into the negative aspect of gang life or being recruited into doing illegal things, how to handle dealing with friends who you love and care for that you grew up with, but they want to get you involved in something unhealthy.
Mm-hmm.
If your family has been fragmented and undermined and they aren't able to share the skill, I want to be a part of having a child having access to a DVD or going to a website, or even with the technology now of smartphones, being able to pull up a situation where they see a young person being pressured, seeing a short scenario of 1 to 2 minutes, and then being able to select, how can I handle that? You're my best friend. I love and I care about you, but I don't want to roll with you in a gang. Mm-hmm. Thereby, you'll be able to have an app for that, be able to pull it up on your phone, look at it, and say, oh, this is one way I can handle it. I saw this scenario done. Or at being able to have a DVD of the situation, or being on a bus stop where kids are gathered, where school is dismissed and you're waiting for 20 minutes, the troop will pull up, set up a mini stage and perform short vignettes and scenarios that will hopefully empower children and also adults who are struggling with addiction. A lot of times we put a lot of attention on young people because they are our future, but we must bring up the entire community and family. And we sometimes neglect adults who are struggling to become empowered, to become self-actualized, struggling from addiction, coming out of possibly being incarcerated and wanting to learn the proper skills to integrate in a healthy way back into our society. I want to produce stage productions that will go into the community, that will be able to perform, as I said, from street corners to concert halls, but also to legislative halls as well, to the White House, so that people will know that people can be empowered through entertainment. Mm-hmm. And so that's the thrust of what I would like to do. And I would like to, anyone who's listening right now to join me, taking power of social networking right now, let me do the pitch. Hit us up on Facebook, all of us, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn. Come and join all of us. If any story you've heard from all three, any three of us motivates you, contact us, become a part of it. Wherever you are in the country or the world, this is what Open Society Institute, I believe, is about and is giving us an opportunity to share it. Being here even with you right now is a testament to that. And there's another aspect I want to share real quickly is that not only will it train them in trying to educate people with literacy and also with life skills, but also a facility where young people and adults will learn how to properly operate the equipment that's behind the technology and actually assembling, deassembling, repairing the computers, the microphones, the cameras. A tangible skill that they can take, whether or not you want to be a performer or a writer, but at least you can be able to operate a camera, and if it breaks down, repair it. All that is encompassed in what I would like to do and will be developing over the next year and a half.
I'm just tired. Listen to y'all. This is really important. I'm very curious, and I'd like to get our listeners in on this at 410-319-8888. I want to hear your thoughts on this. I want to hear what your response would be to Coley Tangela, to Michelle, to Jessica Terrell about the work that they're about to embark on and what it might say to the rest of the country, what it might say to our community, how you might want to be involved, your own ideas around these things. I mean, this is, we're always talking about the problems. We're always talking about the crisis that we face in our communities. But now we're talking about people who are struggling to figure out ways to address those issues, not just to sit back and talk about what needs to happen. So join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can go to steinershow.org and stream this program live, watch our guests, and take part in this that way as well. 410-319-8888 is the number here. So you know, I am curious about, these programs are all really important programs and programs that can affect the lives of the young people that you all are dealing with, the young women in Park Heights. What you're doing, I mean, they're all uniquely different and original programs. Working with young men, the way you're trying to work them to help work through this process if they're charged as adults and they're juveniles, innocent or guilty. And the theater film work that you're doing with young people, Coley. I wonder how this. So you affect the lives of 15 to 20 girls. You affect the lives of 50 young guys. You affect the lives of 25 young people in your in your program. And there's thousands of kids out
there.
How
does it mushroom?
How does it mushroom? And also, how does it affect the way we think about how we have to, even more importantly, how we talk about how we have to talk, how we have to work and change policy and the way we do things to be effective in the lives of these children?
I'm so glad you asked that question, Mark. That's a question that was asked to me throughout this process. Why 15 girls? That seems like a little bit. At the end of the day, Mark, you and I both know 15 girls is not just 15 girls. It's 15 families.
Right.
And not just 15 families, but 15 families and all the supports that they have in place. That might be a member of the family who may be a VA, you know, a member of the VA who's a veteran. So he's got that whole veteran family backing him, and he's got all these other supports in place. You've got your schools in place. You've got your representatives in place. You've got your local officials, state officials, federal officials. You've got You've got folks that it just, if you can just show that if I can shift the mindset, because again, we both know that every movement, every powerful moment in time where some change really happened, it was young people at the core of that change. And if you can get young people motivated to see the difference that their behavior and their actions and their purpose-driven lives can make on one community. For instance, we come back from Ghana, and say in that process when we're back from Ghana, my girls are all in their gold diggers paraphernalia. I'm a gold digger, right? And we decide that we're sick and tired of the alleys. You know, there was a study done that shared more than 50% of the alleys just in Park Heights were filled with trash.
Right.
If we come outside one Saturday afternoon without gold diggers paraphernalia on, and we don't ask for help, but we show civic engagement by cleaning those alleys ourselves, me and my girls, and other folks who want to be a part of the solution, how can you keep coming outside and throwing trash in that alley? How can you keep doing what you're doing when something is happening in your community? And for me, it says that there'll be a contagion that has to happen. And I'm not saying it's going to be overnight. I'm not saying everybody's going to buy into, I don't care about being no African. because I have to totally deconstruct what they think that means. You know, not having a positive attitude toward being of African descent or having apathy or no attitude about it at all. But at the end of the day, I want to give you back your self-worth. I want to give you more. And so it should affect the way you engage in school. I should see your grades get better. I should see that. And my intention, I'm deliberate in my actions. I've already got people in place who want to help me collect data. We want to talk about how we can make it systemic, not just a one-time thing, and show that this engagement has enhanced what's already in place. I have an awesome host partner. I'm going to be working with St. Ambrose Outreach Center. So I got rock stars already in place who've been doing work in that community for 30-plus years. And so we already know that the work that they're doing is directly affecting these young people who are currently involved. And I'm going to be pulling some of the girls from that pool of kids. But at the same time, Mark, that gives us an opportunity to systemically deal with some stuff and really watch it, chronicle it, you know, have the information that'll say, now I need your support from this foundation and that foundation. Give me more resources so next time my class will be 30 girls, or maybe it'll be another 40 girls. And again, it becomes a trickle. I don't like to say trickle down. It becomes a trickling effect.
Hold a thought. Okay. We're going to take a short break and let you come back and pick that right up, Jessica. Join us here at 410-319-8888. Anne, Sean, Carlos, all of you are calling in, and we're going to get to your calls when we come back from this very brief break. And I want to remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Mortgage Late Don't Wait program, the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and support for the Mark Steiner Show and the Anthony McCarthy Show is provided by Watson Caterers, offering personalized service for weddings, special events, intimate dinners, and corporate events throughout the East Coast for over 35 years. For more information, 410-252-2222 or watsoncaterers.com. A lot of good food happening in this town. Number here is 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our webpage, steinershow.org, wherever you're watching to us around the country. You can join this conversation at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at Steiner Show. I just said that, but I'll do it again. steinershow@gmail.com. And we want to hear about your thoughts on this, that this is Baltimore. And what's happening in this town is that through places like the Open Society Institute, pushing for serious policy change in areas that affect the lives of our citizens. And the fellows going out there to do the front leg work, in many ways, of changing the hearts and minds of people on the ground, are funded to do this. And we're talking about three of those programs, and we'll be reviewing a lot of those programs over the course of these next few months, meeting other fellows, and I'll be going out to visit some of these programs and see what they're doing and to kind of bring this to the nation's attention, because we have to find ways on the ground to change things from the community up, not just from the government down, though that has to happen as well, but it's going to be empowered from the bottom. And we are joined by Michelle, who is a known entertainer nationally. She's a rising star in the world of comedy and more. And she's founder of Gold Diggers, the Sankofa Project, which will encourage African-American girls to study their ancestry and heritage. That's the short version. Koli Tangela, comedian, teacher, working with students to develop a theater and filmmaking troupe here in this community. And Jessica Terrell, who is the Bamberger Fellow. And we talked about Clinton Bamberger and his importance in this world. And she's founder of Hand in Hand, working with young people who are charged as adults in our criminal justice system. A policy that should end so that we wouldn't need this. But talk about
Certainly.
That later. I mean, it is absurd to me that we lock up 15-year-olds with grown men. Is ridiculous.
It's actually younger than that. I have one of my students who's 14. He just turned 14 like a month ago.
Insane.
And so he's this little teeny guy in there with people who are 16, 17. And then as you were saying earlier about a mother whose son had been at BCDC or incarcerated for a year, I've had students in my program who've been in BCDC for 2 years and then they go to court or they go to trial and they found not guilty.
Or they are adjudicated.
So what happens is you have these kids who, if hand-to-hand wasn't there, would have just spent 2 years getting angrier and angrier and angrier. And then all of my students come into my class and they say, if we weren't here, we would be sitting ourselves trying to figure out how to do it better next time. So when they come into our program, they no longer think, oh, wait a minute, I don't have to not. They start to think that no longer do I have to do this. And so the earlier question you mentioned about how do we get it beyond just the students that we work with, what we encourage our young people to do, and I mean encourage by supporting them and letting them know that people do truly care about them, is that we want them to go back and help others. So all the time I hear from my young men, Miss Jessica, what inspired you to start Hand to Hand? Because I want to start a program like this. And so you typically think of these young men as like, oh, they're so horrible and so bad. But no, they're not. They just truly need an opportunity to see that they're worth something. Because once they discover that, then they're ready to start. One wants to be a social worker. One wants to start a mentoring program. We partner with youth as resources, and they are going to come in and teach our young people how to write grants, teach our young people how to create their own solutions so that underneath Hand in Hand, they can go out and start their own little mini programs. And so Hand in Hand won't just be Hand in Hand. It won't just be here in Baltimore, to be all these mm-hmm. young people with these solutions that they know will work because they are young. And also, we started with advocacy. We have an intern who I think is amazing. Her name is Mary, and she wants to come in and she wants to teach our young people how to politically advocate for themselves. So learn how to write your congressman, understand what a law is, understand you have a voice, and understand that these myths that people are telling you are ridiculous. You can go to college. I have to tell my students every day, yes, you can go to college. You might not be able to pay for it the way someone else would, but you can still go to college. So that means you need to graduate from high school or get your GED. So don't just give up because you have one charge on your record. And so that's what we're trying to do, is educate these young people, empower these young people, but they want to empower other people, and they're just in BCDC ready to start mentoring programs.
We have to think about what maybe people who create policy and manage this government think about the work that you are doing as OSI fellows and what might be instituted rather than incarceration, rather than putting young people in jail. I mean, I want to open the phone to a little stat I learned just the other night reading Yes Magazine, one of our future partners. And in Canada, they have, if I have this right, 29,000 people incarcerated, I think that was the rate. They have 33 million people in their country. And we have the largest rate of incarceration of any country on the earth, including places like China, Russia, any place you think locks people up. Nothing compared to what we do. And we're locking up kids for the most ridiculous of crimes. And we have statistics about kids who, that the majority of young people who smoke marijuana, and I'm not making a value judgment whether it's good or bad or not, but smoke marijuana, are white kids. More percentage-wise, white kids smoke marijuana than black kids. Who's in jail? Who gets arrested?
Staggering, Mark. That's staggering.
And it's we have to really begin to wrestle with the work you're doing and what it says about different ways we need to think about addressing our youth, not just incarcerating them and not just locking them up and giving them records and throwing them away as if they were useless. You know, I mean, that's the importance, I think, of the stuff that you're doing.
Yeah, Coley Tengela here, Mark. I agree with you wholeheartedly, not only in terms of marijuana usage and those individuals who are being incarcerated for it, the whole disparity that we're that was a hot topic at one time that has gone, by, unfortunately, by the wayside, the disparity between powdered cocaine and crack cocaine. You know, those systemic things that have the overtone of racial dynamic to it that has to be addressed, and that I believe those of us who are progressive, who are liberal, who believe in humanity and life, we have to be just as fervent and passionate with civility, unlike others, not
why,
casting
why
any
Why we
aspersions.
Gotta be civil, though? That's what I'm trying to figure out. I want some civil unrest. I want to start breaking some stuff up for the good of things, you know? I'm being facetious, but no, you know, I hear you, but at the end of the day, we have to empower the adults, too, because we put a lot of stress. Like you said, you said it earlier, Coley, it's a bunch of grown folk that need some help.
I know
they need some
there.
Services, some direct services.
Yeah. And
we're, talking about some direct services. We need to go pick them up.
You're right, Michelle. There's some policy deciding people who have no idea of what is going on. We not won't mention any names, but you're making decisions for people. And you don't have any direct connection of the repercussions of the decisions that you're making.
Right.
Let me open the phones to the listeners who want to join this conversation with three of our new Open Society Institute fellows. And we're saying this, and I do believe in the work OSI is doing. It's very important. And I have a caveat that OSI over the years has contributed money to the Center for Emerging Media and the Mark Steiner Show to help us build a news department at some other place that was very successful, and to build our Just Word series at One of Peabody. We've been doing work with OSI because it's a group that has been really pushing to change the heart of things and giving fellowships to people who are just artists and activists and creating change from the ground up. And that's a very important aspect of work. Few people are doing that. 410-319-8888. Clarence, you're on the air. Sean, you're on the air. Excuse me.
Good evening.
Hi, Sean.
Mark, Michelle, I forgot the other brother's name. All of you Open Society folks. Coley, yes. You might know me. I'm Sean Kofi. But the reason why I'm calling is for two things. First thing is the Open Society, just as you probably all know from your research, has been extremely successful in putting people on the ground in power and being able to develop long-lasting projects that make sense in particular communities. First thing. And my second thing is dealing with each one of your particular seasonings or expertise in terms of community and youth development. Now, myself personally, living in Charles Village, having my own on the ground organization, the Arts Village in Charles Village.
Was that a shameless plug, Kofi? That was a shameless plug. That was a shameless plug, Wolfie. You could have just said having a program. I just want to say, I love you.
Be shameless, brother. Take advantage of your opportunity. Work it. Work it.
Real quick. Particularly working directly with young people in Charles Village. And the reason why I'm saying what I'm saying is there are so many young people that walk the halls of schools where violence is taking place, where people are being disrespected and disrespectful, where ignorance is happening, that simply walk by, that don't have a voice, that are terrorized in their own environment,
right,
that don't have access to say, yeah, I want to be involved in learning about my ancestors, or I want to be involved in the creative arts in terms of theater and expressing myself, or I want to learn how to keep myself out of jail, or learn how to, you know, what happens to a brother when he's put into the system, that these vessels give an opportunity for these young people to have a voice. And I just wanted to give you all, I mean, of course, I know you got encouragement coming from the top and the bottom, but I just wanted to give you all my voice of encouragement to keep moving forward, and that it is definitely a needed point that so many, and I say that on the side of Michelle, that we do need to knock over some tables and knock down some doors. We need that last scene in The Wiz. Can we bring on a brand new day and bust off some ugly costumes and make some noise? But it's so
and
many
some flying monkeys.
All right, Sean. Thank you.
Thank
Sean.
You so much,
thank
Sean.
Thank you very much.
Thank
Kofi.
You. Hey, Kofi, hit us up on Facebook, and so let's fight the good fight together.
Yeah.
You got it, Barbara.
Let us go to Dottie in Baltimore and see what she has to say.
Hi, Mark, and congratulations to all the OSI fellows, and a special hi to Jessica.
Hi, Dottie. Oh, and my host organization is Alternative Directions, which I love.
Oh,
so go ahead and
put
that out.
Okay, hi, Dottie.
Yeah, Alternative Directions is the host for Jessica's program, and I'm on the board of that organization. And I really want to just encourage all of your listeners who are listening to these amazing fellows and the wonderful things they're doing to really get behind programs like this, both in terms of where they put their financial contributions and where they put their energies in terms of the policy changes that drastically need to happen, so that the kinds of situations that Jessica's dealing with in her program just can no longer even possibly exist.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Thanks, Dottie.
Thanks, Dottie, and we appreciate the wonderful plug.
And keep plugging all good things. And,
yes.
And Jessica, let's plug our thing.
Okay.
No, because Open Society has brought us together.
Mm-hmm.
I have always wanted, and Mark, and give a kudos to you, years ago. People don't know this, but Mark Steiner is a wonderful actor in his own right and was a director of a very progressive youth theater troupe many, many years ago, doing community grassroots theater performances, outdoor theater, for different organizations, encouraging and enlightening people. And I had the pleasure of being his assistant director at that time. But Jessica and I will be working together week after next, November the 28th.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be going into the facility where her young people are unfortunately
mm-hmm. really,
and doing a social justice, 2-hour social justice theater workshop with her wonderful young men around the principle of Augusta Boal's Theater of the Oppressed Techniques and Strategies. I am excited and humbled.
My theater
and
father, Augusta Boal.
Yes. Going in and working
awesome.
With those young people with that.
We're super
excited. And that would not have happened if it wasn't for becoming an Open Society mm-hmm. Institute Fellow and working together. And I see other opportunities for us to work together and collaborate.
Mm.
I see the possibilities of breaking down some barriers, and mm-hmm. particularly wanting to work with the Asian community here in Baltimore. And this could be replicated throughout. There is an unspoken schism between African folk in urban areas and our wonderful Asian brothers and sisters, and that barrier needs to be broken down. And I've approached...
We can start by breaking down that big window that separate them from the people that's buying all the stuff that they got in their stores. How
yeah,
about that?
That's one thing, and we're going to be dealing with that theatrically, too, mm-hmm. with members of the Asian community working with African people from America in theatrical performances and in a film format. Those are the boundaries that have to be crossed. And even within the African community, globally, there's a lot of young people who unfortunately get involved in violence. But I have worked with some young African men and women who have been unfortunately in their home country been kidnapped and forced into being child soldiers and warriors and dealing with their trauma from that. Where you got some young people who have this bravado of using violence and killing another African person here in America, but then you have a child that had no choice who was kidnapped and drugged and forced into being a child soldier, bridging those gaps. And those are the things we would like to do. And I had this opportunity of working with this incredible young lady.
So what's going to happen this Saturday? What's going to happen in this thing?
It's going to happen. Well, Mr. Coley's going to come in, talk to the young man, give him a little background about what it is to perform, theater is, because a lot of my young men, when I say, do you guys know what a play is? They're like, yeah, Medea. And I'm like, yeah, that's one form of, you know, that's one type of play, but there's all these other things. And I want my young men to be culturally
motivated. You're talking about Tyler Perry's Medea, not Medea from the classical theater.
Yes. That one, which I do love Tyler Perry.
Thank you for qualifying Mark Steiner.
Oh, you're right. And I do love that. And I think it's great because I think he's bringing plays and drama to a lot of people who normally wouldn't be watching it, but I want my young people to know about Shakespeare. Why don't you deserve to know about Shakespeare and all these other wonderful, wonderful playwrights who have really changed, you know, the way we read and we act and we write? So I'm super excited for Mr. Coley to come in and just talk to my young men. And it's also great to see males come in and work with males, because we have a lot of women. Not that women can't hold it down, because my ladies and I are doing a pretty good job, but it's also good for the young men to see other young men interested in what they're doing. So if you like to, we're always looking for mentors. Any type of mentor, anybody who wants to come in, you want to volunteer, you want to teach, you want to do whatever, you know, let us show our young people we believe in them.
Let me go back to the phones. This is okay. Really good. 410-319-8888. Hadia, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hadia.
Hadia, I mean to say.
Hi, Mommy.
Hi, Hadia.
That's so nice.
Do you have a question, Hadia?
Yes.
Okay, state your question, Hadia.
What are we having for dinner?
Okay. Thank you so much, Hadia. I will see you shortly.
What are you having for dinner? I want to know, too.
I love you so much. You're the best girl ever. And we will discuss dinner when I see you and give everybody a kiss. Bye, Hadia.
Bye.
I love it. That was great. What are we? I love
now
it.
Cute. That is a shameless plug.
Now, I know that. I know it's gonna be some delicious vegetarian food, though.
Yes, absolutely delicious vegetarian.
That's what I was asking. What you're gonna have? Because I might have to stop over.
No, you have to go to sleep. We already had that discussion. Let's take the next call, Dr. Steiner.
410-319-8888. David, you're on the air.
Good evening, Mark, and to your distinguished group of change agents. This is David Miller.
Hey, David.
Fellow, and I just really want to congratulate, you know, the three new recipients of the fellowship, and also really want you guys to really begin to think about this whole notion of transformational leadership, because we got a lot of leaders in different cities, but we need transformational leadership. People who are going to be leaving a living, breathing legacy on the lives of children, youth, and family in this city. So I just wanted to, once again, just say congratulations to you guys and hope to connect with all of you guys at some point.
David
Thank you so much.
From the class of 1999, the very second class of fellows.
David does amazing work.
Amazing.
David, let me ask you a question, and maybe panel can comment on this maybe. What we talked about earlier about the power of what fellows do and what you do, I mean, you're a post fellow, but you're doing incredible work along with Michelle's
Lamar
husband.
Darnell shows up. David is the chief visionary officer of the Urban Leadership Institute.
He is that. And so, but I'm curious, when you talk about transformational leadership, what do you think has to happen? And what these examples of the work you do, that Darnell has been doing, that Lamar has been doing, I mean, say, and that our fellows here are doing, how do you galvanize that into a larger spirit when you talk about transformational leadership in terms of really transforming society and how we approach our children and our communities?
I think, David.
Oh. Okay. Let's not hang up on folks and let's say goodbye.
Goodbye, David.
But y'all can answer
goodbye.
That question.
Goodbye, David.
Thank you.
I think transformational leadership that will actually leave a footprint for someone to come through and walk that walk with you and continue your work. I get the sense that David is saying we can't just start programs and end them, but we should empower those who've experienced the program on some level and maybe give them the sense that you too can actually continue this work. You can transform the situation from being a one-time experience to an experience that's a legacy that's going to keep happening. It'll change the lives of the people who experience it and those who actually become the leaders of those movements as well. That's my impression.
What I think is that we encourage all of our young men to come back as mentors. So I really believe in the mentor relationship and how important that is. And for our young men to say, we've been here, we've been through that, and to come back and to work with someone else.
And I just wanted to share, and I'm quite sure my fellow fellows would agree.
I'm a fella.
Yeah. would agree.
That's the feminine version of fellow.
That's the feminine derivative.
Feminine derivative of yeah. Fellow good. Fella.
I'm the first fella. She the first Bamberger.
Yeah, that's right.
Bamberger rah.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. What I want to say is we would like for someday someone that we have worked with throughout our programs to eventually replace us or replicate mm-hmm. what we are doing. That would be the greatest tribute to what we are doing, to find out someone that we work with will go on and continue right. our work. Mm-hmm. If we want to veer off and do something else, and right. then we begin to see that our child that we have nurtured,
right.
who is going to take care of it, what better tribute and honor and knowing that it's going to be safe if mm-hmm. someone came through our program mm-hmm. and will take it over. Mm-hmm. That is what I am hoping shall happen with what I'm developing, and I'm quite sure they may feel the same way. And two, And two quick shameless plugs. Got to do it. Got to do it real quick.
Though,
real
quick.
I don't know everything, so I'm going to ask people to meet me, Coley Tengela, one of the 2010 class of fellows at the UB Blake Center on December 2nd, 6 to 8 o'clock. I'm having an open house. I'm inviting people, business people, folks from the political community to come and meet with me. I want to share the work. I will probably be having some of the students I've worked with perform. We'll be showing some of the films and also sharing that anyone can do this. If we have achieved this, some have been doing this work for quite a while. Some of us haven't. But a tribute that the Open Society Institute is just open for everyone. And great people. Since this happened, I'm on the Mark Steiner Show today. Yesterday, I had the privilege of being on HughVoices.com, which is an international African-centered news blog site, all because of this opportunity. And just want to spread the word that if you're listening out there and you have an idea, if you've been doing things in your community and you would like to have some help, apply. Apply to the Open Society Institute. No special requirements needed other than your passion and the belief in wanting to uplift people.
And a solid program.
And a solid program.
solid program.
Or ask us questions. I'm more than happy to. I know probably the younger people. I really just want to empower the young people because I am young and because so many people told me that I couldn't do it because I was young. So if there's any young person out there or anyone out there who has been told you can't for whatever your circumstances are, I'd be more than happy to talk with you and work with you because I know what that feels like.
Or if you're young at heart.
Young at heart's important. Let me go to the phones. David actually called back.
Oh.
So, David, now you can – did you hear what I said, David, before earlier?
No, not really.
Well, very quickly. We only have a few minutes left, so we don't have much time. But okay. The issue was you talked about creating a transformative leadership.
Right.
And you, I want you to describe in a very succinctly, though, so we don't have much time now, what that means and what you think this kind of work can do to create that in this country of ours.
Very concrete, you know the question that we got to ask is, what are we waiting for? And to be very, very concrete, transformational leadership is getting involved in a cause, whether it's volunteering, whether it's writing a $10 check to one of the fellows every month. There are some things that we just have to do, Mark, to sustain the efforts to improve the quality of life of children and families. And I think whether it's a fellow or just an ordinary citizen that's listening to the broadcast, there's so many wonderful organizations. Part of the transformational leadership model is getting connected with a charity or an organization that's doing visioning work to improve communities.
David, it's always good to hear from you. I'm looking forward to talking soon and getting on the air to continue that conversation on juvenile justice we had and bringing the folks from the Ella Baker Center in Oakland on here with our activists in Baltimore to kind of create a national conversation about what we can do to change what we have. You look like you're about to say something to wrap this up. We have 1 minute left.
I was just going to say, you know, to keep the balance for me, you know, I perform as a stand-up all over the country. But the balance for me also to be able to still have the fuel to do this kind of work is I always entertain both sides of my brain. And so this week I'll be debuting in a musical, Zippy the Pinhead.
Oh, I meant to say that. I haven't gotten here to tell you.
At the Baltimore Theater Project. That keeps my brain in balance.
It opens tomorrow night.
It opens Friday night.
Oh, Friday.
So we'll be there Friday, Saturday, and Sunday of this week and Friday, Saturday, and Sunday of next week based on the long-standing, long-running award-winning comic strip Zippy the Pinhead. This is the musical, so I'll be Mayor of Dingburg in the musical, and we'll be there for 2 weeks. Please check it out at theaterproject.org.
Plug something?
We only have like 10 seconds.
Okay, so I hope that everyone could come out on December the 17th to support Hand in Hand. We'll be at Johns Hopkins University SDS room. Come out, be a volunteer, come meet some of our young people, and get some of their work.
And we'll put all this stuff on our website.
Yay!
So it'll all be there for all of you. I want to thank Jessica Terrell, it's great to meet you. Congratulations
on
the Bamberger Fellowship and all of you for your fellowships, Coley Tengela.
Thank you. Join us. Fight the good fight.
And Michelle.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you so much.
Folks, we're going to take a very brief break and come back. On the way there, I'm going to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's Credit Union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's Credit Union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. Keep your money local. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner here with my partner, Anthony McCarthy.
Great to see you, Mark.
And we are going to talk about a bunch of things in the course of this hour and have guests joining us by phone. We're going to look at a number of things, starting with the idea that the new energy panel chairman for Congress says you have nothing to worry about because the Bible says we're not going to have global warming. So I guess it makes no difference who wins elections, does it, in America? We'll be back to talk about that in just a little bit more. Right now, we're going to turn this over to WEA Traffic Locally. If you're watching us on Free Speech TV, you'll see a little different pattern and some music and voices. And stay with us. We'll be right back. Don't go away.
Support for WEAA is provided by Luna. Information on flooring available at luna.com/traffic or 877-241-LUNA.
Traffic this time, a service of Anvil PM. Believe it or not, we are still looking at a closure on 100 eastbound over at 10. The accident scene closer to Catherine Avenue, but they're shutting you down at 10, a detouring you, and give yourself a lot of extra time on that stretch. Right now, we've got a slow go on the west side, Beltway 95 up to 70, doing it, but doing it at 19 miles per hour. Outer loop, not too bad, but congested to be sure as you head down from Liberty Road in toward the Edmondson Avenue stretch on that west side. Top side remains heavy from the 83s in toward Harford Road and rolling at an average of 35 to 40 miles per hour there. Accident-wise, Essex at Liberty involving a pedestrian over on the west side in Lockern. Ramping up a problem, Pulaski at Joppa, but now we're getting some attention along Earls Road at Eastern Avenue, and that's where a motorcyclist went down. Matt Tacka, Baltimore area traffic.
Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. Before we jump into this, I'm going to remind you that support for WEAA is provided by BCF, the Baltimore Community Foundation. BCF helps donors and their financial and legal advisors who want to invest in a better Baltimore by offering a full range of charitable options. Information at bcf.org. You're listening to the Mark Steiner Show here at WEAA 80.9 FM. Public radio station, voice of the community at Morgan State University in Baltimore, Maryland. For all of you watching across the country and the world on Free Speech TV, we welcome you once again to join us here and everybody watching us streaming online at steinershow.org. The number is 410-319-8888 on our way to our toll-free number. Those of you with a cell phone, it is toll-free after a fashion. And you can write to us here at steinershow, S-T-E-I-N-E-R show.org, steinershow at gmail.com. And we're going to talk about all manner of things. We're going to look at the issue of global warming and the next Congress and what it's going to tell us. We're going to talk about this new report coming out today about Social Security and how you're going to lose all your money if you thought you were going to retire. What does that mean for us? And talk a bit about the Middle Eastern foreign policy as well that came out today. We have guests joining us from throughout the hour, Janet Redmond, Megan Carpenter, and Phyllis Bennis during the course of the hour to join us. And you, of course, 410-319-8888. I thought we had a clip, but we got a little clip problem here. Not anybody's fault. Just happened. And I'll just tell you, folks, I'm going to posit a question to my dear friend Anthony McCarthy. We'll have Janet Redmond on here in just a minute to join us as well. And Janet is a co-director of the Sustainable Energy and Economy Network at the Institute for Policy Studies. And the proposed incoming chairman for the Energy and Commerce Committee in the House of Representatives is Representative John Shimkus of Illinois. And John Shimkus tells us that we don't have to worry about anything because God promised no more catastrophic climate change after Noah. That's what the representative told us. So that it raises some questions. What happens when you have the head of an energy committee that says we don't have anything to worry about? What happens? Now, there's an argument going on in the progressive community and people across this country, the majority of Americans who put hope into office at one point in 2008. And many people now are really disgusted and think we want a transformation. We don't see transformation happening in America. And stayed home. And that was your right, or to vote somewhere else was everybody's right. But can we say there's no difference between a chairman who might compromise but fight for issues around global change and a new chairman of the Energy Committee that says there is no climate problem in the world and God will fix it?
Well, I think
We got to pot up Anthony's thing? Yeah.
Is it up yet? There we go. Yeah. So, yeah, I think, Mark, and certainly you and I have an immense amount of respect for people of all faiths. And
oh, absolutely. It,
most definitely.
Yeah.
I have been disturbed over the last 24 hours as this video of chairman or supposed incoming chairman, Congressman Shimkus of Illinois, has been circulating around the Internet.
Yes.
But let's be clear. He uses a reference in the Bible about God not destroying the earth through climate change because of the flood. But in fact, the promise that God made for those of us who have studied the Bible and other books of faith, that he would not specifically, God would not, the creator, would not specifically destroy the earth by water again. And that, you know, that was the extent of the promise. And we were called on to be faithful and good stewards throughout the Bible of the earth and those things that we have dominion over. And so I think Congressman Shimkus, and the scary part, Mark, is that more than half of the incoming new congresspersons are climate change deniers. They do not believe that global warming is scientific or realistic. And in fact, campaigned on those issues and were elected on those issues. So I think we have a serious problem, not just with this climate change debate, but when the man that's in charge of one of the most powerful committees that has everything to do with oversight and regulation of all of our energy believes that the conversation around global warming and climate change is a non-starter. So that's where we start from, that the chairman believes that you can end the conversation because spiritually we're going to be okay. I hope this is, I don't want to overstate it, but I hope it is as concerning to others, including Republicans, as it is to others who care about the environment.
Join us here at 410-319-8888. What are your thoughts on this issue? We are now joined by Janet Redmond, who is co-director of the Sustainable Energy and Economic Network at the Institute for Policy Studies. And Janet Redmond, welcome to the show once again.
Thanks so much for having me.
How are you?
I'm very well, thanks.
Good. It's good to have you with us. So tell us what your take is. We are looking at a Congress coming up with a very, very different makeup.
Yeah.
And it's true that the majority of Republicans now going into Congress are climate change deniers. And there's a lot of argument about what climate change means. We've debated that in the show before. And there are things we might even learn from those who say this is not as simplistic as we make it. However, we're facing a pretty serious issue. And what's your analysis of what we're about to face in this new Congress?
I mean, I think you've kind of hit the nail on the head. We're going to see a huge kind of upheaval in a bunch of different committees that are really important in the House in particular. You've mentioned energy and commerce in the House. You know, Shimkus would be really scary for the climate change issue. As you said, he's a climate change denier, which is interesting. Also, he's one of his largest contributors is, of course, a nuclear energy company, Exelon. Other top donors include National Rural Electric Cooperative. That's a coal fire association that uses coal fire power plants for electricity. So, I mean, certainly part of his position is ideological, but clearly you have to look at who has been funding his campaign and what interests he represents. So I don't know that his position is purely about his religious views and his faith, but it's also about where he's getting money from. Even looking at Upton Barton, which are, you know, two of the other front runners in this conversation still, if Barton is able to get the waiver, the technical waiver. I mean, again, not all Republicans are made the same.
Right.
Upton at least accepts the climate change science. He doesn't think there has to be anything done about it, but at least he accepts the science exists. But even folks like that have been really said out loud, they're gonna start raking people like White House climate czar Carol Browner over the coals, looking at the EPA regulation and seeing, whether or not the carbon dioxide finding of the EPA that it poses a human health threat should stand. I mean, we're going to see a lot of changes across the board. Other committees I think are interesting to look at are the Natural Resources Committee in the House. Richard Hastings, Doc Hastings, who's against the moratorium and deep water drilling and called it kind of unscientific, called it a job killer. Is the new majority senior ranking member there in the Natural Resources Committee. Of course, the Speaker of the House, Joe Boehner, doesn't think CO2 is a problem, doesn't think that humans have much to do with global warming, doesn't see a problem with that at all. Even the House Science Committee, the senior Republican, the committee is Ralph Hall from Texas. Then, of course, James Sennenbrenner is right behind him. Both of them are global warming skeptics. And, of course, I'm sure we're all expecting to see the Select Committee on Energy Independence and Global Warming,
mm-hmm.
which Mark, you've been a champion of, fall apart. I think it's done for at this point. So we're going to see a lot of mix-ups across the board, so it's certainly concerning. I think one of the interesting things about the election, though, is a couple of the signals that it sends us. I mean, really interesting. If you look at who won and lost in terms of Democrats, you know, over here at the Institute for Policy Studies, we've been looking at how the Congressional Progressive Caucus really only lost two races, Grayson and Feingold, Hall and Hare done. But, you know, of their 80 members, they lost a few members. The Blue Dogs lost more than half of their membership. So they went
True.
From 54 seats to 26 seats. So that, I mean, it's not saying that, I mean, certainly those progressive seats are shored up, but what it does say is the folks we have in Congress, the Democrats we have in Congress, are more progressive, so we've got a stronger progressive bloc. We can no longer kind of have the failures of Congress be blamed on Democrats. I think what we're going to see is, you know, people who are pushing a progressive agenda on climate change and energy responsibility, energy efficiency, pollution in general, what that means for communities' health and community resiliency, can be consolidated in that Congressional Progressive Caucus. I think it's really interesting to note that more than two dozen of the Democrats who voted for cap-and-trade legislation actually lost. So what that might also be telling us, of course, is that people didn't like the way cap-and-trade legislation worked. They're looking for a different kind of climate change policy in the future, and I think that's we're gonna see different kinds of policy happen. I don't expect any kind of large, comprehensive climate energy bill, and it will be challenging even to get small pieces, renewable energy standards, compliance standards, other forms of regulation through. But I think the job is to really connect those smaller pieces to people's lives on the ground right now and to move the climate change issue forward in this next Congress.
Interesting. I think that we're going to see in this Congress, we're going to see if Democrats and others can make the case that changing energy policy will build jobs. And I think one of the things they've done and all the kind of corporate funding we've seen in this campaign, what they've been able to do is to convince everybody that if we start legislation to change our energy policy towards renewable resources and to change the way we do things and to deal with the issue of climate change, that you're going to lose your job. So
right.
people are terrified of that, and that makes sense. I mean, people have to pay their bills. They have to raise their families, and they've been very effective in doing this. But I think that – I mean, this is a chance to kind of really unwrap the debate, I should say, before it does unravel
exactly.
in a different way.
There's a critical issue that you're bringing up, and of course it's jobs, 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 jobs in the
right.
economy, and those are the things that really impact all of our lives across the board, and I think it's right for us to think about that. That's where we should have put a lot more energy probably leading up to the election. But I think what's important to recognize is that, you know, regardless of what we do. So I think you think of climate change. Is it happening? Yes. The planet is warming. Even if you don't believe it's warming, even if you don't believe that humans have caused it and humans
right.
can do anything about it, it makes a whole lot of sense to start changing our economy because, to be perfectly honest, China's kicking our butt right now. They have an incredibly huge
to put it succinctly. right.
Fairly. I mean, they've invested incredible amounts of public money into their renewable energy economy.
Right.
They're exporting renewable energy technology to the U.S. Those are jobs that we should have in the U.S.
There's a solar company closing down in the state of Maryland and moving there.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
That's abominable, right? So
it is.
Saying, even if you don't believe that climate change is real, spending some public money on job creation in the renewable energy sector is just good for jobs. So you can pretend that climate change isn't even happening. That's okay if you don't believe it. At least do the job creation work that people need in this country because, to be perfectly honest, we're being outcompeted, and that's a sad, sad fact. And we're one of the, you know, we're pioneers in this industry. We should be having those jobs here in our own communities.
Janet, this is Anthony McCarthy. Real quick before we go to the phones, I just want to ask you, a lot of talk over the last couple of days about a real opportunity for progressives around renewable energy, around energy policy regulation because of the exact reason you pointed out. The Blue Dogs took a beating.
Mm-hmm.
And now what we have are emerging progressive leaders who were reelected, who stuck by their guns on the stimulus, stuck by their guns on health care reform, Wall Street, energy, climate change. And they were sent back to Congress. Do you think that this emerging class led by Nancy Pelosi or Hoyer or Clyburn, or are they ready to have a real conversation, a progressive conversation about jobs, about competition, with these real polarized Republicans, real clear in their position, being in charge of Congress?
You know, I think it's less an issue of whether they are. The answer is, of course, they
That's
have
right.
to
be. They have to be. You're right.
They mm-hmm. have to be. And so, I mean, part of the responsibility of organizations like my own, think tanks, other kinds of citizens groups, whether it's grassroots or grass tops, faith communities, churches, synagogues, people that are organizing in the communities that are particularly hurt by all these issues. I mean, it's really time to step up support and step up the ideas. I think that, you know, progressives in Congress are open now. They've got this space. They're open to real innovative, interesting ideas. We've got a bunch we're putting on the table. For example, a financial transactions tax. The idea of basically taxing at a tiny, tiny, tiny rate, 0.05% mm-hmm. Transactions on stocks, foreign currencies. In fact, parts of the financial sector that are largely untaxed at all, and putting that money, which could be $175 billion a year just in the U.S., putting that money to work for job creation and the environment, in the new energy economy, and lifting people out of the situations they're in right now, heading toward poverty. It's a real problem. So, you know, I think there's some innovative ideas that people have had in their back pocket waiting for a moment. And even though it looks depressing and we're not going to get huge amounts of legislation through this year, I think it's the time to start arming our progressive allies with those really good ideas so that they can build momentum behind those ideas as a bloc.
Before we go, move on to the issue of Social Security and what this new committee has done, with another guest, and let's get a couple of calls in here who want to comment on what they've just heard. 410-319-8888. Clarence, you're on the air. Hi, Clarence, you there?
Yes, I'm here.
You're on the air.
Hi, Clarence.
Yes, good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
Quick comment. The problem to me is simple. Our political process has become a bake sale. That's simple. I made this comment before in reference to changing careers. I've changed careers 3 times in my life. And what I see is a group of people who have political power through the entities that they work for who will not make a transition from one job to another. Back in the early 80s, we didn't cry when Magnavox and RCA and all of those other people moved overseas. We just changed careers and moved on. You've got people in the coal industry who won't make the transition because they don't want – this is a problem with the society and the people who work in these industries who have the power and money to elect politicians to support their positions, whether or not it's good or bad for the company or not. And like I said, the political process is just a sale. That's basically what I wanted to say.
Clarence, thank you so much for that thought. It is a sale, but things are, I think the nuance of all this to me is that this thing is very complex. I mean, I had a discussion with a guest we had on the other day, yesterday, Kevin Zeese, who I respect a great deal, and his thoughts and his analysis of what's going on. But when we say that Congress and President Barack Obama are owned lock, stock, and barrel by Wall Street or energy companies, I think that doesn't advance the conversation very much. That the conversation has to be that these corporations have a huge amount of power in determining our lives on Capitol Hill and control a great deal there, but that we have a battle on that hill and in these communities and the streets ourselves to change that. That's where it needs to be.
And that progressives and the other voices have got to be diligent yeah. in speaking up, showing up, and being a part of that debate every time it takes place. It was a great show yesterday, Mark, and I think that oftentimes we have found ourselves since the primary election, since the general election, and Democrats took that real shellacking, as the president said. We found ourselves in a position where we kind of see things as black and white. We see that Democrats are and Republicans are not in the mood to compromise, not a lot, as Janet said, is going to move forward over the next year. But it really gives progressives an opportunity to be a part of demystifying a lot of these issues that are impacting us on the ground, especially jobs. And it's up to the progressives to get in this fight.
Janet, we're going to have to move on to Social Security. You want to have a closing thought for us?
Yeah, I mean, I just even to speak on the caller just said, you know, I think the other really critical piece right now is that we can look not only look deeply into the progressive blocks within Congress and really support that and bring the ideas back home. But it's time to kind of look locally. It's time to do mayoral organizing. It's time to look at city councils and town councils and really do a lot of progressive organizing there as well. I think, you know, this 2 years maybe buy us some time to spread our messages and to really dig our ideas and dig our heels in firmly around those progressive ideas and then be prepared in 2012.
Janet Redmond, thank you so much for being with us. We look forward to having you on again very soon.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great. Janet Redmond, who is co-director of the Sustainable Energy and Economy Network at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., joining me and Anthony McCarthy here on the Mark Steiner Show, broadcast on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community here at Morgan State University in Baltimore, Maryland, and being broadcast around the country on Free Speech TV and around the world, and at steinershow.org, where we stream this show. You can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Let us go now to our next guest, and we'll get to these other callers calling in as soon as we introduce Megan Carpenter, who is associate editor of Talking Points Memo. Megan, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you so much.
And Megan, you say Megan or Megan?
Megan.
Okay. See, I knew I was going to make a big mistake. Megan, gotcha. So let's go on way back to the phones, and Mark in Michigan, you're the next caller up. We're going to come to your call. The issue here is this new report on Social Security and the Debt Commission report. A battle will brew over this report. We're talking about raising the age of Social Security benefits to 69. We're talking about less money for most people. They say more money for people lower income, but less money for most people. And even though all reports also say that the Social Security is solvent for the next 27 years, and we've been invading that trust to pay for everything else in this government, Social Security Trust Fund, that we're talking about cutting taxes again on the very wealthy, cutting taxes on corporations, not even talking at all about taxing wealth of any kind in America, which is where the big money is, which is why wealthy people stay wealthy. Not that I want to take away all their money, but people have to pay something for what they make back to society. And so this is once again, what it seems to me at least, and Megan, I'll let you jump in here. This is being done once again, it seems like, on the backs of regular working people, and we're not talking all about the military or anything else.
Right. I mean, the Fiscal Commission was supposed to discuss how to reduce the deficit and the debts writ large. And in the report, you know, for the first 5 years, what they want to do is basically cut spending. And then they look at really broad tax reform policies, many of which, as you noted, mostly bring down rates, particularly for people that currently pay higher tax rates, but also eliminate a lot of deductions and credits that those people get. And then they get down to sort of the brass tacks of where a lot of our deficit is coming from, which is entitlement programs as opposed to discretionary spending. And the big item in there is Social Security cuts, basically, is they look at how to reduce the amount of money that goes from the budget and from tax revenues and into paying out Social Security. And they do a lot less work, actually, as we noted on Talking Points Memo today, in talking about how to change Medicare, which is government spending on health care for senior citizens. Although they do have a lot of cuts to Medicaid, which is a program designed for
poor,
lower-income people, yes.
I mean, even there, I mean, the part of the problem with Medicare is what happened during the Bush administration, and this Congress, Democrats and Republicans don't want to deal with, which is the giveaway on prescription drugs that was in that program that we'd never figure out how we're going to pay for. We're just going to put it in there,
right?
Because the drug companies want it there, and they can make some money, and let's put it in there. I mean, I don't think we're wrestling with the brass tacks of what we face and what we have to do, because we all have to pay for this. And we're all part of it. And I think the question is, given the new Congress, where this is going to go. I mean, it always seems like already people are acquiescing on the tax cuts for the most wealthy and keeping those in place. And I think most Americans oppose that. And I'm curious what you all think around the country. 410-319-8880. Before we go back to the phones, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask, Megan, if, as we were reading Talking Points today, how much of this do you think will become policy, taking into consideration this new Congress? I mean, there's a lot of grand ideas. There's a lot of red meat for progressives in this. There's a lot. How much of this will become policy?
Well, I think at this point that's very difficult to say because when the Fiscal Commission was initially envisioned, it was supposed to be almost like the base reassignment commission so that it would actually have powers to compel Congress to do things and to limit Congress's ability to amend its proposals. And when that didn't go through, in part, sort of ironically in retrospect, because Republicans were concerned that it would lead to tax hikes, the president appointed the commission himself. And so now the commission can only issue a report if 14 of their 18 members can agree. And there's no clarity given this proposal today, which came from the two co-chairs and which seems designed to be a negotiating text as opposed to the end-all be-all.
Yeah.
There's no real clarity that they can even get 14 votes to vote in favor of some version of this, let alone then bring it to Congress and have anything on it voted up or down. So it sort of sets a baseline for the kinds of gaming out of reducing the deficit and reeling in entitlement spending over the course of the next basically 65 years. So children born today would be affected by most of these, you know, the sort of long-term proposals in terms of Social Security and Medicare. But it really is almost like they went to one of those online games that said, hey, like, click here to fix Social Security, and you sort of sit there and you look and see how many, you know, things you have to do in order
that's right.
to make Social Security permanently solvent. And that's really, to some degree, what this reads like, is how can we cut all these things out of discretionary spending and cut some of these entitlement programs and completely change the tax system in a way that has never been able to get any sort of consensus from Washington and fix everything all at once.
And what nobody is talking about in all of this, and then we're going to take a break here and go to Mike, your next caller up at 410-319-8888 before we move into some foreign policy realms. Megan Carpenter will stay with us for a bit here. But the issue, just a second, the issue that we're going to go to, really has to do what we're not talking about. Nobody in the campaign talked about the $1 trillion this wars are costing us or the $1 trillion this prescription benefit program is going to cost America. And what? How about addressing those before we start talking about taking away working Americans, Social Security from many Americans? When you realize that 10% of Americans own 96.4% of the 90.4% of the stocks, the rest of the stocks belong to the rest of us. What do most of us have to live on? Our Social Security. Because most of the money we did have invested in those private funds went down the drain and aren't coming back. So there's got to be a different answer. I think people are going to demand a different answer in America. I want to know what you think at 410-319-8888. We are going to take a short break. On the way there, I want to remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorder Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advanced stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538. We'll be right back.
Support for WEAA is provided by
The Park School, welcoming parents to an open house on Sunday, November 14th at 1 p.m. for lower school and 3:30 p.m. for middle and upper schools. Learn about Park's dynamic learning environment where faculty inspires intellectual curiosity and students learn to think. For more information, 410-339-4130 or online at parkschool.net. The Park School open house is Sunday, November 14th. Healthy Babies Baltimore. Far too many babies in Baltimore City die before their first birthdays because they were not sleeping safe. The safest position for babies to sleep is on their backs, where they are less likely to choke. Your baby's sleeping area should be clean and clear. No blankets, pillows, or stuffed animals. Your baby should always sleep safe, alone, on their back, in a crib. No exceptions. Information on how to help your baby sleep safe online at healthybabiesbaltimore.com.
And the generous support of members like you. Thank you.
Hello, listeners. I'm Ernestine Jones of Gospel Grace, inviting you to WEAA's Gospel Holiday Benefit Concert, December the 5th, 6 o'clock p.m. And that's the hit live Richard Smallwood Envision on Morgan's campus in the Tyler Ballroom. Get your tickets at WEAA, Ticketmaster.com, or by calling 1-800-745-3000. This special event is being brought to you by Morgan's MBA program and Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community.
Hey there, it's me, Kyle LaRue, your co-host for the Cool Jazz Countdown. Join me and the bassman, Marcellus Shepard, for our weekly trip through the top albums in jazz.
We'll take you inside the music as only we can and keep you plugged into the artists making it happen.
So join us each week right here on the Cool Jazz Countdown.
Each and every Friday at 1 p.m. on the Voice of the Community, WEAA 88.9 FM.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. Support for the Mark Steiner Show is provided in part by Watson Caterers, offering personalized service for weddings, special events, intimate dinners, and corporate events throughout the East Coast for over 35 years. For information, the number is 410-252-2222 or watsoncaterers.com. You're listening to the Mark Steiner Show here on 88.9 FM, the voice of the community here at Morgan State University in Baltimore, Maryland, watching us around the country on Free Speech TV. On streaming live on the internet at steinershow.org. And my partner and often co-host joins us today to talk about the politics of the day, Anthony McCarthy, whose show airs here every Friday in the same time
slot.
Great
to be with you, Mark.
Always good to have you here. And on the phone, Megan Carpenter, associate editor of Talking Points Memo, one of the great blogs out there that young people have just taken journalism and taking it over, which is a good thing, Megan. I'm glad you all are doing this. Someone has to do it. Is Megan still there? Did we lose her? Oh, I guess if we can get Megan back, we'll do that. Join us here at 410-319-8888 around the country, wherever you are. We want to hear your thoughts on the issues we've been raising. We're going to talk about some foreign policy issues as well. We're talking about this report about cutting your Social Security. Is that the answer? And cutting taxes down to the bone? I'm not quite sure how this gels and works together. I mean, what do you think? 410-319-8888. Remember, if you're in Michigan or California, wherever you're calling us from, it's toll-free on your cell phone. Join us here, 410-319-8888. And Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, Mark. It's good to talk to you.
Good to have you here. Thank you.
I like to weigh in on the global warming issue.
Okay.
And I happen to be a chemical engineer. And 30 years ago in chemical engineering school, they taught us about the effects of industrial gas, namely carbon dioxide. They did studies in the greenhouse, and what they did is they doubled the amount of carbon dioxide and grew plants, and they measured the mass, the biomass of the plants. When they doubled the carbon dioxide emissions, or the carbon dioxide in the greenhouse, the biomass of the plant doubled. They doubled it again, the biomass of the plant doubled again. So it was a linear, the plant matter is linear increase. So the result of the study, this is over 30 years ago, was that we cannot go back to pre-industrialized carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, otherwise there'd be mass starvation on the planet, and it would only be worse today. And my second point is, in New York State, where I grew up, they always said that where you're standing, we were about under 1,000 feet of ice during the ice age. The planet is getting warmer. It's a natural sun cycle. The founder of the Weather Channel has a piece that you see on YouTube.
I've seen it.
That basically proves that it's independent, carbon dioxide emissions and Earth's temperature is independent. So, and then there's Climate Gate and some other stuff. So I think there are other things we could do, like plant trees, eat more fruits, which is more trees, you know, cluster developments. There's dozens and dozens of things to
do. I'm not a chemical engineer, and I've seen with the early thing you say challenged by lots of other people on this program as well in debates. As just not absolutely correct about that. And I think there's some truth in it, but I think it's you're taking it as a gospel I don't think exists. And I think that, yeah, it is true. I mean, I think that one of my dear friends, Charles Stein, who is a scientist who I respect and who was one of my mentors as a young man, as a kid, also says this climate change, he thinks, has more to do with the natural warming of the planet that happens over millions of years, and we're in one of those cycles. And that could be very well true, but that does not preclude the capturing of greenhouse gases and how that's changing. I think that is the truth, I really think, is incontrovertible. I mean, it's there that exists. So this is when you put global warming in the context and in light of the natural warming of the planet, we're in trouble. You can't, and even beyond that, let's just say for argument's sake that you and some others are correct. And I don't happen to think so, but let's say that you are. The side effects of pollution, of gas, oil, coal usage, on the health of the planet itself, on destroying entire species, of destroying our waterways, of the health of the people on the planet, of issues of asthma and breathing and any other issues, so many other issues we could talk about, that in itself says, even without climate change, we have to do something different. We can't keep, and the natural disasters that come out of coal mines and out of strip mining and out of mountaintop removal and out of oil spills, and we have to really, I think, address that. So I hear what you're saying, but I think that it's dangerous for us to kind of posit this as climate change is not happening because of industrial pollution.
I absolutely agree with what you said about the other pollutants. I mean, to me, burning stuff, you know, mercury issues and nitrous oxide emissions or acid rains, and these are very important issues. The only thing I'm really against is I don't believe in carbon credits. And you know, a farmer, if he wants to have a cow or a few extra cows on his pasture, he has to buy carbon credits from somebody. I mean, farmers are typically poor. I mean, what needs that? You know, I would love to see hydrogen fuel, for example. That's hydrogen and car powering cars. I believe they do it in Norway a lot.
They're beginning to.
Yeah, and you know, nuclear power. To me, nuclear power is a big favorite of mine. It's very, very clean, provided you know you do it safely, and then you know put the spent material in some mountain somewhere.
Depends on whose mountain it is. Yeah. I don't want them in my mountain. Go ahead.
Yeah, down in Nevada, where they put this in the mountain, where you know it's spent fuel, and it's not going to bother anybody. So I mean, it's very clean nuclear fuel. And yeah,
But the other part of what you were saying, I think that we need to have. There's an interesting article that I've only begun to read, that I have to read over the weekend, that I want to come back with for a conversation, which is, I'm blocking right now, whether it's in Scientific American or Smithsonian. But I want to share it and get the author on here. She believes in climate change, and she's a scientist, but she's saying that we do a disservice to those who challenge the accepted notions of climate change and don't listen to people who have other ideas about what is actually going on. And there is some knowledge there that you can't just dismiss. And I think she's right. I think people get too, you know, self-assured that everything they're saying is right. And there's politics in climate change as well as politics in the people who deny climate change. So I think that, but I think in the whole, we're seeing global warming, I think, advancing more rapidly than it would or should. You can't stop global warming or cooling in the longest run because it's the nature of our planet. No more than we can stop ourselves from dying or, you know, anything else. It's a natural cycle of things, but this is something beyond a cycle. This is like saying we get old and sick and die, but because of the chemicals we ingest, I now have cancer. That can be avoided.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But carbon dioxide itself, just the molecule we breathe out as we're sitting here, is not this great evil that people are making it out to be. And you know, it does. There are a lot of benefits. There are a lot of scientists saying the carbon dioxide is a benefit. Yeah. When we burn coal, to me, when I look at that, the worst part about burning the coal is all the other stuff that comes off of it. And there's a whole bunch of noxious sulfur dioxide,
carcinogens,
noxious oxide, right. Mercury, all, you know, unburnt carbons. And then these trash incinerators, they're all bad, too. I mean, they spew out stuff. And they're really, there's no such thing as a non-hazardous waste incinerator, because once you incinerate it, everything, it burns the same way. So even the municipal trash incinerators are bad also. So, but those, we should be doing a better job of cleaning the stack gases that we have. We don't do as good a job as in Europe. In Europe, and so I went over to Sweden to look at the stacks over in Germany and Sweden, and they actually have carbon filters
right
on their municipal waste incinerators to take out take out the mercury. I was looking at the strip charts, and you can actually see all the, you know, the little batteries you have in your transistor radio or whatever. You actually see spikes in what's coming out the stack from the mercury going off.
Well, you can also see in places like Germany where they are closing down coal mines and moving into renewable energies, and they are changing the way they do things, and we don't have the wherewithal to do that. Mike, I really appreciate you being part of the show. You've added a great deal to it.
Well, thank you for having me.
Take care. Thanks for joining us. On the way back to the phones here, I think we have another guest coming on, Phyllis Bennis, shortly to talk about the foreign policy issues. We're here at 410-319-8888. Anthony McCarthy and I talking about the issues of day in Congress. I want to hear your thoughts out there about climate change, about the new takeover of Congress and how that could affect climate change, the questions of the Social Security system and the changes that are being proposed by this debt commission. Wherever you're listening to us from around the country, let us know, 410-319-8888. We want to hear your thoughts. And let's go to Tim. You're on the air.
Hello, Mark.
Hi, Tim.
Hi, Tim.
How are you doing? I hope your daughter's enjoying the last little polar bears. The thing that always drives me a little off center is when people are trying to bring quote-unquote knowledge and science into the issue. And there are a lot of other factors in climate change, sunspots, et cetera, and they might be up to 0.5% of the difference.
Right.
So those things are natural. But what isn't natural, and what we really need to get common ground, because without common ground it's difficult to have a good dialogue, is to focus on what Charles Keeling had started in 1958. Now, this was a pioneering gentleman that went into Mauna Loa in Hawaii, found a nice pristine area, and began the with precision and continuously measuring carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And when he started, it was about 320 parts per million. It's now 389 parts per million. So that Keeling curve is incontrovertible evidence, the facts, not opinions. There's no left wing, right wing. It's the hard facts, like you're taking a temperature of your child to find its temperature. You don't sit there and go, well, maybe it's 105, maybe it's 104. These are the facts. And from that, we know that the carbon dioxide is building up in the atmosphere, and it's doing it rapidly. And we also have tagged the carbon. The scientists are pretty sharp. They actually know it's coming from fossil fuels. So these are a baseline with which we can have a discussion. And instead of getting everybody excited, we say, based on these facts, what should we do? And that becomes a much more interesting conversation.
Well, it is. It is. I mean, I think that, I think it's a conversation that we want to enter into on this show in the coming months a great deal, because I think that it's the what we should do. There are a lot of people with their heads in the sand about what we should do. And I think that a lot of people who, even on the side of folks who want to see renewable energy in our world, there are so many people who think we can just do it. That we can switch on the solar power, that we can switch on the wind power, that we can make that change. We're talking about a 20, 30-year transition period that we have to be willing to commit to as a nation, as a planet. And if we're not, it's not going to happen. It's about who gets the subsidies, how you begin to desubsidize oil and coal and gas and subsidize renewables so that they become economically viable so people will invest in them. Because people won't invest in them if they're not economically viable.
Absolutely. I sometimes think, Mark, that the problem with some of our good, pointy-headed, brilliant scientists is that they're not paying attention to what motivates people.
Right.
And how does this communicate to people?
Right.
And that's the barrier we need to get and not let it be co-opted by others. So when I do a lot of engagement in lectures and communities, and when I get there, people are very positive. I rarely get somebody that's just totally mindset
right.
the other way. And then it's kind of fun because we can start talking about the realities. And I'm just privileged because I'm actually working on the climate change inputs into college curriculum. And knowing that these are 10- and 20-year transitions and trying to make sure that people have a baseline of knowledge that makes sense.
Tim, I'm glad you joined the show. I appreciate you being part of this. It was great to hear you. And please write to us and give us more of the stuff you're working on. We'd love to hear more from you.
You bet, and enjoy the book.
Thank you. We'll do that. Thank you so much.
You bet. Bye.
Number here is 410-319-8888. We're going to move into a different area. Anthony McCarthy, of course, is in the studio with me as we talk about the issues of the day that popped up in the news. And one of those issues has to do with foreign policy and what's going on with the announcement that our troops may not be coming home as fast as we think they are in 2011. And what's going on right now in the Middle East with the continued quick construction of apartments and houses in East Jerusalem and Palestinians resisting, and what that's doing to the peace talks. And we are joined for this part of our conversation by Phyllis Bennis, who is the author of Ending the U.S. War in Afghanistan, a primer, and director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. It's an IPS day here. And Phyllis, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
So, Phyllis, let's talk your thoughts on all the number of these issues. It came out today very clearly that troops are not leaving as quickly as we thought. What's your analysis of what's going on?
Well, again, I think we have to be clear here that while this is a more explicit set of statements that we've heard, not from President Obama directly, he's still in Indonesia, but from top-level officials, an important article in the McClatchy Papers analyzing all this, this isn't really new. I think that mm-hmm. We have resisted the reality that President Obama, as candidate Obama, even while saying, I will end the war in Iraq, I will end the mindset that leads to war, but I will escalate in Afghanistan. This is a promise kept, and I think many of us said when we first heard his analysis after the four-month decision-making process around his Afghanistan strategy, when he said, we're going to escalate, we're going to send 30,000 new troops, and, oh, by the way, at the end of July of 2011, we're going to look to see whether or not it might be possible under some circumstances to consider the possibility that it could be a future, et cetera, et cetera. We might remove some troops. It was never a promise to end the war by that time. It was never a promise to begin serious withdrawal. It was always discussed in the context of being conditions-based, not time-based. And from the day after that announcement, the top officials of the Pentagon and the State Department were deployed out to the talk shows to say, don't worry, this doesn't mean an actual withdrawal. This just means a consideration of where we might be able to turn over security authority back to some Afghan forces, as is possible determined by the situation on the ground. Instead, what we see is that with the escalation of 30,000 new troops, a cost of $33 billion, that's, the cost of 600,000 new green jobs with $3 billion left over to start some infrastructure projects around the country, if we're going to look at the cost of war, which we definitely should be.
Mm-hmm.
So we're looking at a situation where it was never a claim that we were going to pull out at that time, and now we're saying, well, we're just not going to pull out because things are tough but improving, something like that. The reality is things are getting much worse. Despite the larger number of troops, the U.S. is failing more dramatically than ever. Casualties are up. There have been, just in this last year, since the last time, if we look, for example, at when was the last time that the Obama administration invited any anti-war activists, experts, anybody, to go to the White House to hear what they had to say, at least briefly, for a brief moment, that was about a year ago. Since that time, there have been 3,000 U.S. troops wounded in Afghanistan, several hundred more killed, $100 billion of war spending wasted, of which we should note that about $400 million has gone directly to the Taliban for protection money, and then 50,000 Afghan children have died of preventable diseases during that 1 year. Afghanistan is still, according to UNICEF, the worst place in the world for a child to be born, and thinks she will survive to her first birthday.
And there's so many things coming up that people, I think, may just begin to be able to put their hands around, which is that we are now in a situation in Afghanistan where, whether you like them or not, and I have no love for the Taliban, and many people in the globe do not, and many Afghans have no love for the Taliban as well.
Absolutely.
But they are, what we're ending up doing, we are now once again fighting an indigenous movement.
Absolutely. And we are not an indigenous movement.
Not there, we are not.
A government made up of former warlords. We used to acknowledge that they were warlords. Now we call them parliamentarians and ministers. But they're the same leaders of the militias that fought with the Taliban. The Taliban won in 1996. Then they fought again with U.S. backing in 2001, and the Taliban lost that time. But while it's certainly true that the Taliban are indeed just as brutal as the reports that we hear, so are these government warlords. You know, I think people sometimes imagine that the situation on the ground in Afghanistan is sort of the Taliban versus us and the good guys. There are no good guys, including our forces, who are forced to do horrifying things. But the distinction between the Taliban and the warlords who masquerade as a government is a very small distinction. You know, if we look, for example, at that horrific example that has been established in the last couple of years, we've seen signs of attacks on young girls with acid thrown in their face, a horrific attack on the rights of women. These were young girls trying to go to school. Well, that didn't get invented by the Taliban. That particular act of brutality was invented by a guy named Gulbuddin Hekmatyar,
right,
who was a U.S.-backed Afghan Mujahideen, or Afghan Contra, if you will, back in the 1980s. We supported him. President Reagan brought him to the White House and introduced him to the world as the founding father of the new Afghanistan. He's the one who first used that tactic of throwing acid in the face of women students 10 years before that, back in the 1970s, when he was a student at Kabul University. So this notion that somehow we're supporting the good guys because these people will accept when required to make sure that they keep their U.S. money and their U.S. protection, they'll say all the right things about, oh, yes, democracy, oh, yes, constitutions. But the reality of life for Afghans, particularly Afghan women, 80% of Afghans do not live in the cities. They live way beyond the reach of this government, and their lives have changed only for the worse since the U.S. occupation began.
So, and I think this is something we can't get into deeply here. One day I'd love to hear your thoughts, maybe a little bit on this right now, that we talked about here with some other experts and with a friend of mine who'll be coming on the show, who's one of my old teachers, is that a lot of this, some of this war, piece of what we're looking at here, between the Russians and what's going on in Central Asia and in Afghanistan, has to do with control of water, and we never talk about that. The water of Central Asia, the water of the Tibetan Plateau.
Water is indeed a huge part of it. So are other resources as well. The question of natural gas.
Right.
Afghanistan has this unfortunate position of being a country without significant amounts of either oil or natural gas, but with a very strategic location in an area where it's surrounded by countries that do have oil and natural gas and want to get to markets. And Afghanistan is the likely route of pipelines. But I think we have to be careful. I think it's very important that we not become sort of reductionist, if you will, on mm-hmm. the economics of it.
Mm-hmm.
The pipeline issue, the water issue are important, and they're part of the reason why there's such resistance to ending the U.S. occupation. But it was not the reason that we attacked Afghanistan
Correct.
In 2001.
Correct.
That was politically driven. It had political motivations. It was not for control of pipelines at that moment. That was hovering in the background, perhaps. Very few people even knew about it, I think, of the people making that decision. It was for crass partisan goals of preparing the way to invade Iraq.
And Phyllis Bennis, it is always a pleasure to have you on. You were just so insightful and clear about the issues. Phyllis Bennis, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy day to join us for a little bit here.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Good to have you. Phyllis Bennett is author of Ending the War in U.S. and Afghanistan. She is director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. I'm joined this hour, of course, with my colleague and friend, Anthony McCarthy, host of the Anthony McCarthy Show here at WEA every Friday from 5 to 7 p.m.
Great to be with you, as always, Mark.
Any inklings of what you're doing Friday?
No.
Okay, well, just we can announce it if you were.
There's some things breaking even as we speak, yeah.
I want to remind you all the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines. It's a simple way to stay connected to the topics and events you care about most. Daily content on arts, culture, food, design, style, green living, and much more can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at UrbaniteBaltimore.com. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered today by Zachary Coleman and Afi Jackson. Assisting that engineering today behind the glass. Our interns today are Shari Barnes, I think just Shari Barnes, and she's back there today. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear new additional interviews, find out information about all of our guests and the work that they do, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and for Free Speech TV, where you hear the news, get the news you'll get nowhere else. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by MECU, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development.
A holiday tradition begins with WEAA's first Gospel Grace benefit concert featuring multi-Grammy and Stellar Award winner Richard Smallwood. Sunday, December 5th, 6 p.m. at the Tina and Calvin Tyler Ballroom located inside the Morgan State University Student Center. For ticket information, 1-800-745-3000 or Ticketmaster.com. Gospel Grace's holiday concert is presented by the Morgan MBA program and Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Perhaps you've decided it's time to become a member of Public Radio WEAA, but you're looking for the best way to fit it into your budget. A sustaining membership may be the answer. You decide an amount that can be automatically deducted from your debit or credit card account. Most start with $10 a month. The amount is totally up to you. A monthly contribution is easier on your budget than an annual gift, and you'll be joining other sustaining members of WEAA. Become a sustaining member at 410-319-8888 or online at WEAA.org.
Preserving a 40-year legacy of preparing urban leaders. Morgan State University cordially invites you to attend the first Grand Gala celebrating the new School of Social Work, Friday, November 12, 2010, at the Valley Mansion by Martins. 6:30 p.m., VIP reception, 7:30 p.m., dinner, music, and dancing. For more information, Stephanie Howard, 443-885-3537. This has been a public service announcement of WEAA 88.9 FM.
Public Radio 88.9 FM. Promoting the preservation and forward progression of jazz, music, and culture. WEAA Baltimore.
From PRX and NPR, I'm Al Edson, and you're listening to State of the Reunion. And in this hour, we're bringing you stories of veterans finding their way home after serving our country. How some are discovering a new mission after fighting in combat.
That's one thing that agriculture can provide, is that direct impact. You have a mission statement, you're feeding America.
How wounded veterans are renewing their inner strength by competing in sports.
Well, when we're at home, he's always having to meander through people and everybody, you know, gawks and stares. But out here, you know, he's got people to talk to that actually are going through the same thing he's dealing with.
And we meet one Vietnam veteran who's finally making peace with his past.
I didn't feel like I used to feel years ago. I was sinking. I couldn't get myself up. And all of a sudden, I'm not even trying. They're helping me.
A special veterans episode on State of the Reunion. But first, this news.
Home sales dropped in Baltimore 30% in October. I'm Beverly Burke. This is your news on Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM. You know they were keeping figures on this when buyers were rushing to beat a deadline for the $8,000 federal incentives. Buyers closed in on about 1,500 homes in the metro area. That's down sharply from the 2,219 that sold a year earlier. Baltimore City's school board approved opening four new schools in the 2011-2012 year. Three will be charter schools, one transformation school. Orioles legend Cal Ripken Jr. is promoting an online game to help improve students' math skills. From now until May 15th, students will go online and compete for prizes. And the grand prize will be tickets to the All-Star Game as guests of Ripken. As it turns out, Baltimore is the first city chosen for IBM's Smarter Cities Challenge. It's offering up $50 million worth of technology and services. And the Maryland Food Bank reports there's an increase in demand for food for families who were considered middle class. It's a fast-growing segment. Last year, 2,500 families received donated groceries. And we've got flu season right now. The Centers for Disease Control say everyone 6 months and older should be vaccinated. This season has one vaccine for three flu strains, including the H1N1, and supplies are plentiful. St. Joseph Medical Center will pay $22 million to settle claims by the federal government. The hospital engaged in a kickback scheme with the Pikesville Cardiology Group, Mid-Atlantic Cardiovascular Associates, involving unwarranted heart procedures. And a Nebraska abortion doctor says he plans to open his first new clinic in suburban Maryland. This after Nebraska instituted new restrictions on abortions. Dr. Leroy Carhart says the new law bans abortions after 20 weeks of pregnancy. I'm Beverly Burke. This is your news on Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community.
From PRX and NPR, you're listening to State of the Reunion. I'm Al Letson, and with this program, we travel the country to examine the things that bring us, as Americans, together and the issues that pull us apart. But this episode is special because we're not going to a specific city or town. Instead, we're focusing on a community that's spread out across the country, even across the world. They're vital to this nation and have been from the start. Our men and women in uniform, the United States military.
5 years after setting foot in Iraq, the world looks radically different to me. I have a profound desire for simplicity. Since my daughter's birth last September, I feel compelled to answer the question I know she'll eventually ask, why were you in Iraq? I very distinctly remember asking my father the same question about 20 years ago. He never had an answer either.
Riley Charbonneau was in the Army for 7 years. In 2004, he was deployed to Iraq. One of his assignments was at the infamous Abu Ghraib prison, where he was an overnight nurse in an emergency room that he helped build.
We got to Abu Ghraib in early February, and those photos started to hit the news about a month later. So when we landed at Abu Ghraib, nobody had ever heard of it. By the time we'd been there 2 months, every single person in the United States knew it.
When he returned home, like many veterans, he had a hard time processing his experiences. When people asked him about the war, it seemed impossible to sum it up in a few words.
One of the most profound realizations for me coming back is that it seemed like a lot of people really lacked the skills to be able to articulate that they cared, even if they wanted to. People that really loved me deeply, we'd start to talk about this, and they'd ask, you know, invariably ask the question, what was it like over there? And, you know, there just isn't a way to answer it.
But then a friend from college, Monica Haller, contacted him.
I had a really basic questions. I wanted to find out, you know, from real people, what we were doing over there in Iraq, both with the soldiers and also with the Iraqi people.
She kind of just asked me a few questions about my experience in Iraq. And, it, you know, we were probably on the phone that first day for like 2 hours. In the course of those conversations over the next week or so, I happened to mention that I had this hard drive full of photos. And I sent them over to her, not really thinking anything would come of it.
When Monica got the pictures, she started talking to Riley about them, and she realized he didn't remember taking some of the photos or even